Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome back to Unheard. I'm Florence Reed. Woke. It might be one of the most overused words of the last decade, but like it or not, the word itself and the politics that it describes seem to be here to stay. So it's probably a good idea to ask, what do we really mean when we call something woke, and why does it even matter? With luck, someone much smarter than I has spent many years considering these very questions. Her name is Susan Nyman. Susan is a world-renowned moral philosopher and the author of many best-selling books, most recently the gnomically titled Left is Not Woke. I'm holding a proof copy here. Professor Nyman joins me live from the East Coast to talk more about it. Thanks for taking some time to talk to us today.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
So let's start with, because we're doing some philosophical heavy work here, I hope. Let's start with a bit of a working definition, because otherwise what we're going to do is kind of stray out into the wilderness of wokeness without any real sense of what we're talking about, because woke is a word that doesn't really have a working definition per se. So in the context of your book, what do you mean when you call something woke?
So what's really interesting is that on every single subject that I've ever written a book about, people always want me to give a definition. And I have to argue that definitions are not actually what we need. We need analysis. And I've had this conversation about evil, over which I wrote a book. I've had this conversation about basically everything that I've ever written about. What we need are analyses, not definitions that allow us, you know, give us a rule which says this is woke, this is not, this is evil, this is not.
This starts us on a tricky beginning, because the problem is here, of course, is if we can't define what woke is, then how can we say the left is or is not woke?
Well, you know, it's like the famous statement about pornography, right? You recognize it when you see it. We're all talking about it because there is a phenomena that everywhere I go, whether or not I mention the phenomena, the title of my book, I have other people starting conversations, and I travel a fair amount. I have friends in many countries, and it's not me that's starting these conversations, it's them. And I decided to write this book after the fourth or fifth conversation in which an old friend who I would have identified as left all their lives said, "I guess I'm not left anymore. Look what's happening to the left." Certain kind of identitarian politics, a certain confusion of justice with power, a certain despair about the possibility of progress, even as people are say that they're working for progress. And I decided, no, I'm not giving up the word left. I've been on the left all my life, and so have you. Let's examine whether or not the left is really woke, or the woke is left. I actually couldn't decide which way to have the title work. Both of them would have worked, but my publisher said it was too complicated to try and say left is not woke and woke is not left. What I have done in this book is to provide some criteria of what it means to be left and liberal. And I'll tell you what they are. These are three principles that both liberals and leftists have in common. We believe in universalism and not tribalism. that the most important thing connecting people are not the accidents they were born with, but the convictions that they have and the principles they stand for. That's number one. This does not mean that everybody has to be all the same or that cultural differences are uninteresting. Of course, cultural differences are interesting. But the fundamental thing that holds us together is a sense of human dignity that we recognize in every other human being, no matter where they came from. That's number one. Number two, we believe in the possibility of making a distinction between justice and power. Now, it's often a very hard distinction to make in practice, but the idea that justice is not simply one tribe's accumulating more power than the other is deeply important both to liberals and leftists. Finally, the belief that progress is possible through the efforts of people working together. This is sometimes caricatured as the belief that progress is inevitable, which I was going to say no person in their right mind ever believed, but in some pieces of both Hegel and Marx, it looks like they are both saying that progress is inevitable. This is different from the claim that progress is possible, which was a revolutionary claim round about the 18th century. Now, all those three principles are common to people who are liberals and leftists. There's one principle that distinguishes leftists from liberals. So that's a fourth principle. And that's just the idea that along with political rights that we have towards freedom of speech and freedom of worship and the right to vote for who we want and travel where we like, all those are liberal principles. We also have social rights. And those are rights to education, to healthcare, access to culture, a whole set of workers' rights that in liberal countries and among liberals are called benefits or safety nets or even entitlements. And that's a very different concept than thinking that believing that all of those things are rights. They were codified in the 1948 UN Declaration on Human Rights, which was ratified by most countries in the world. It's never been entirely put into practice, but to be a leftist as opposed to being a liberal means that you think these aspirations in the UN Declaration of Human Rights are not utopian, it's possible to achieve them.
Is it that, and here we're reaching a kind of definition by negation, which maybe is a classic philosophical thing to do, but might also be quite confusing for our audience, but those principles then, if they are not what wokeness is, does that give us a hint to what wokeness is?
It does give us a clear idea of what wokeness is, and unfortunately, my thesis is that while there are a lot of leftist emotions among the woke, they're guided by the same emotions, okay? A concern for marginalized and oppressed communities, a desire for justice, the interest in working towards progress. They're caught by theories that undermine those genuinely decent emotions which they share with people on the left, and that's the confusion. So that when people talk about the woke left or the far left or the radical left, they're actually, you know, they're noting a set of emotions, but the theories that have taken over in public discourse in the last 20-30 years undermine what are genuinely decent and praiseworthy emotions, so that we're going in the opposite direction that we intend to go in. Or we, when I say we now, I include also those who get called the woke left, but are being undermined by the theory. Now, this does not mean by any means, you know, that everybody's a philosopher and that everybody has studied deeply, say, the works of Michel Foucault, who's the most quoted author in post-colonial studies, or Carl Schmitt, weirdly a Nazi, a totally unrepentant Nazi, who has had a lot of influence on the left. I'm not saying that people who consider themselves to be woke have studied seriously the works, but they pass into the culture. They're in fairly straightforward forms. You can see them in the media. You can see a set of assumptions in the media, and that are based on some very wrong-headed philosophy. So I thought it was time for a philosopher to come along and try and untangle that.
It's a shame as well that it seems that there are so many misreadings underpinning this movement, if that is the case, because it does seem to have cropped up in academic circles. It's amongst university graduates that this kind of ideology seems to have caught grip. And so why is it that those people who should surely be the most highly educated, the most well-read, have fallen prey to such bad misreadings of these kind of classical texts?
That's a great question. I don't think they're misreadings of classical texts, though. I think that...
Misusings, perhaps.
Well, no. I think that the sort of foundational theorists of woke and post-colonial movements are just dead wrong, okay?
So they've started with a really dodgy bit of theory, and then they've opened out from there. Okay.
That's exactly correct, okay? Now, why? What's the appeal of this dodgy bit of theory? I think it's because liberalism has been so disappointing in so many ways. And frankly, I don't think the left has gotten its act together since 1991. I don't think there has ever been enough of a serious public discussion of why state socialism collapsed. I always have to say this, I'm not a Stalinist, I'm not a defender of the Soviet Union, but the collapse of state socialism has been used to suggest, in Margaret Thatcher's famous words, there is no alternative to neoliberalism. And that's basically the view that has swept the majority of the world. And many people who would have traditionally called themselves left really didn't know what to do, weren't in a position to do a sort of careful critique of what had gone wrong with state socialism, what might be changed, how it might work differently, and were quite helpless. And then on the other hand, people see the failures of liberalism, the ways in which, although many countries, I guess Britain and the United States, sometimes I'm not sure of either, but many countries profess a commitment, say, to equality of opportunity in a situation where everyone knows the gap between wealth and poverty is increasing enormously, where everyone knows how much influence money and corporate sway has on politics. So I think that's one reason why people are attracted to the theories of this Nazi, Carl Schmitt. Carl Schmitt showed or wrote about the hypocrisy of liberal democracies. And he wrote about the hypocrisy of countries claiming to stand up for freedom and democracy and yet holding vast colonies. He talked about Britain's colonial empire. He talked about the United States and the Monroe Doctrine. And of course, he's absolutely right about that. The problem is, what people fail to notice is, he's writing about that in 1942. You know, that is, this is support for Nazi Germany and basically saying everybody else is just as bad. They're just slightly more hypocritical about, okay? So we can go ahead and colonize, Europe, all the way from, I don't know, Belgium to Vladivostok, because the people we're fighting basically did a softer version of the same thing. Now, and by the way, one of the things that always shocks me about Schmitt, about the so-called left's embrace of Schmitt, is this is not somebody who, at the end of the war, decided, he was wrong. He didn't, ever. to the end of his days, he insisted that he had been right. And his favorite place to hang out, aside from his little village in northern Germany, was Franco's Spain. He thought it was a great place.
It's more than a small irony that potentially, if you're right and Schmidt is the kind of thinker of a lot of these woke ideas, that the group who online are quickest to call other people Nazis might actually have been themselves infected with Nazi ideology without even realizing.
It's something that academics know who've spent some time with it. It's also something that everybody knows about Heidegger, who's also enormously influential on leftist theory, who was also a completely unrepentant Nazi. But they are certainly more influential than the people I think we should be listening to and reading, which are the philosophers of the Enlightenment. But Schmidt and Heidegger are one side of the theoretical influences that I think are extraordinarily mistaken. The other is the French thinker, Michel Foucault, who is the most quoted thinker of post-colonial studies. He's not someone who, these are people who are dead and have been dead for a while. So it tends to be their students and epigones who get read in college classrooms. But I would wager, I haven't done a study, I would wager that if undergraduates who are not specializing in philosophy read one book of philosophy, it's Michel Foucault's Discipline and Punish. Now, Foucault is a very slippery figure. He certainly was not an unrepentant Nazi. And I even have one friend, actually the friend whose apartment I'm sitting at the moment, who thinks I'm
dangerous. This is dangerous territory. You might get evicted.
He's read my manuscript. He offered some criticisms, including saying, you know, he thought I was unfair to Foucault. He once had a 3-hour conversation with Foucault in which Foucault claimed that all that he was doing was for the sake of liberation. But Foucault is a very slippery figure. What disturbs me so much about Foucault is not necessarily the tribalism. That's not his issue. His issue is that there is no distinction between justice and power. There's a very famous and very interesting television debate between him and Noam Chomsky that ran on Dutch television in 1970. I highly recommend it. It's still floating around on the internet.
Back when TV used to be good.
yeah. And afterwards, Chomsky said that Foucault was the most amoral man he ever met. Foucault took a very radical view of the idea that moral judgments are not something we should make and not something we can justify. But rather than justifying that claim, he's just dismissive. He's very contemptuous of anyone who makes moral judgments and talks about justice rather than power. One more point where I think Foucault's influence has been disastrous. In many of his books, Discipline and Punish being the most famous and typical one, he talks about how things which looked like they were progress, that looked like reforms that would make the world better, actually turned into what he saw as a more insinuous and a more disturbing form of oppression and repression. And it's that message that has infected the woke to this day, because, you know, they're often unwilling to acknowledge any form of progress.
Maybe this moment is a good time to move on to a discussion of the real world and Black Lives Matter in particular, which is something you do speak a lot about in the new book. Because to me, that seems like a really good example of a time in which justice and power has become somewhat muddied, and that if you took the view of the opposing side to the woke left, which some might call the far right or just the right wing, their arguments during that time was often that there had been a confusion between what it meant to have racial justice, fight for racial justice on the streets of America, and an idea of black power over white power, which was the, I think, the underlying anxiety that a lot of the right, justified or not, had about that moment, the Black Lives Matter moment, which I think led to slogans like All Lives Matter, which I think if read sympathetically, which is what we try to do here, is basically a plea for a kind of a treatment of the issue as a universal issue, as opposed to a tribal issue. And so I think in Black Lives Matter, there was this moment where we did have to grapple with the problem of some people exerting more power for the first time in history, and how that made the other side feel, and the feelings of injustice, whether it was or not, that they had about that. What's your take on it? In the book, you kind of bring quite a nuanced lens to it, but I'm just interested to know how you respond to that.
Thanks for that question, which is really important. When Black Lives Matter began and George Floyd was murdered, I could not have been more supportive, happy, glad. I had just published a book called Learning from the Germans, which was about the idea that the US, Britain, and other countries needed to look at their own historical crimes, in similar manners to the way that the Germans have done, not perfectly, but still to a greater extent than any other nation has ever done. So it initially seemed to me that what was happening was exactly what I had been calling for. And I'm of the age where you weren't supposed to go on the street without, there were no vaccines in the middle of the pandemic. So my kids were out on the streets. I was not, but I was giving Zoom talks and donating all of my honoraria to Black Lives Matter legal fees. And I was absolutely as supportive and moved as I think it was possible to be. Something changed in the late summer or fall, or early fall of 2020. And what changed is the universalism of the movement. Now, there's sociological data, at least in the U.S., I don't know what it's like in the rest of the world, more than half of the people on the streets were not people of color. More than half of the people who were engaged were not people of color.
I mean, you could see it in the footage. You could just watch the videos of people out there. There were many places, like Portland's a good example of one, where you would be lucky if you saw a person of color. It was 99% white. Some of them, I reckon, were wearing balaclavas just in the hope that someone would, not know which race they were because they were so white.
Well, unfortunately, Oregon is so white. It was a state that, once prohibited black people from living there. Portland is very white. But yeah, you're absolutely right. You could just look at it. But some sociologists have run the numbers and came up with them. So that's a good thing. At a certain point, the leaders of Black Lives Matter, but also some of the white supporters, moved into a very different form of discourse, which is that the new line was that this had to be a black movement for black rights for which white people could be allies. And my response was, guys, I know what allies are. Allies are people who, have for a limited period of time similar interests, like the United States and Britain and the Soviet Union during the Second World War. And as soon as the interests diverged, the U.S. certainly went all out in the Cold War to They didn't care if they supported old Nazis, as long as they were good anti-communists who could fight the Cold War.
Yeah, it kind of underpins being an ally. You have to have something to gain. You can't have nothing to gain from the situation.
Correct, correct. And it's about interest rather than principle, okay? I supported Black Lives and still do support certain pieces of Black Lives Matter out of principle, okay? And that's very different than supporting it out of interest. And
tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
All of those white people who were out on the streets in the middle of a plague, they were not supporting it out of interest. They were supporting it out of a commitment to justice, a realization that Black Americans get much less justice than white Americans do, and that they're proportionally much more likely to be arrested or killed by the police. Now, this doesn't mean that I support All Lives Matter, okay? I mean, I do.
In principle.
Of course, All Lives Matter. But most of the people who were shouting All Lives Matter were... First of all, I think there was a touch of racism in many of those people. Philosophically, what they were doing was asserting a very, very banal truth, of course all lives matter, and ignoring the empirical one, the actual fact that Black lives are more threatened by the police than, white lives. There's always an interesting question about whether I'm Jewish, so whether Jews are fully white. At some periods we've been considered not at all. It's at the moment many of us are not considered, but there's a difference between my walking down the street and a friend of color walking down the street. There are places that I would worry.
Here's the question of intent, though, and I think this might be the crux of the Black Lives Matter problem, is that there is a misunderstanding of the other's intent. I think many on the All Lives Matter side would argue that their intentions are just the same, to celebrate the unity of humanity and the equality that we should all be striving for, hence all. Whereas the Black Lives Matter movement, the activists, they would say that, well, the point is we need to focus on this one area of injustice before we can look at the universal. In the end, though, I think many might agree that there's a kind of universality at the heart of it. It's just that the words are different, the language is different. We start to get bogged down in this kind of misapprehension of each other's intentions. And it spirals from there. I don't know, maybe I'm being too kind.
That is a good point. And there are bad faith actors on both sides.
I mean, that money that you gave early in the Black Lives Matter movement, you said it went to the legal fees. Do you know that it went to the legal fees? Because it does. There is some evidence to suggest that it didn't.
I know. And, my intention was in a pandemic where people were demonstrating, Black people were being arrested, usually at a higher rate than white people. And the pandemic was raging in the prisons. It seemed to me that the best thing I could do with any extra money I had would be to, you know, help people get out of prison. Okay, that seemed in the spirit. I'm still glad I gave it. You know, I don't regret it. I hope some of it went to what I intended it to go to. You're right about assuming the worst intention on all sides, and I think that's something that we need to watch out for. You're absolutely right. But they're bad faith actors. And what you're doing now, and I understand that you're doing it because trying to disconnect power and justice in real practical terms is often very tricky. But I'd like to get away from the power discourse because I know very, very clearly how many white people is always such a weird constructed category, as is people of color. But I know how many white people, you know, genuinely were out in the streets and elsewhere and still are, because they know historically how much injustice has been directed towards Black people. And I fear that the people who shout All Lives Matter are not facing that injustice. And that's injustice that I want to face. That's the difference between my position and theirs. Okay, I want to acknowledge the deep injustices that have run through our societies without making injustice a tribal category, okay? Even if one tribe in a particular, you know, historical moment or many historical moments has been subject to more injustice than another, what I care about is justice, not tribes.
I'd be interested to know how you've been received in your academic settings, with your colleagues and students, as someone who's not afraid to look backwards, some might call that conservative, to look back towards the Enlightenment figures who now have been roundly disabused of their position in the canon by many kind of postmodern academics.
No, I'm saying they're not the true leftists. Forget that. But that's exactly why I wrote this book. I am still, I've been a committed leftist all my life. And I haven't changed.
But this is also what people say. They say the Overton window has shifted. I didn't change. The left changed. And therefore, I'm no longer on the left. So what do you say to someone who's having that experience?
I'm saying, look again at exactly what kinds of views are being held by the woke and ask yourself if those are truly leftist views. That's the point of this book. Look, and of course, I suppose I have been and will be called a conservative. I begin the book by saying I'm not a liberal, I'm a leftist, and I'm happy to be a socialist, okay? So let's start right there. Not everybody is, I am. And I also mentioned the fact that I'm the director of the Einstein Forum, and Albert Einstein in the middle of the McCarthy period was completely proud to call himself a socialist. So that's, you know, those are some of my antecedents. My other antecedents are the Enlightenment. And when I first began to hear around the turn of the millennium that the Enlightenment was Eurocentric and racist.
This is like universities who now have to do a mea culpa when they talk about Kant, that because he was a white, heteronormative man with racist views, that his writings should be taken with a very big grain of salt.
Correct. And, you know, not only him, but the entire Enlightenment. I mean, at this point in time, if you say the word Enlightenment, except to damn it, you're hit with the claim that you know, you Eurocentrist, racist white person, how dare you? And when I first started hearing these claims, they weren't as widespread in the early aughts as they are now. But I just thought, this is frankly so ignorant that it's going to go away. And I don't even need to address those reproaches because they're so unfounded. Well, so much for my ability
Your
to
optimism.
Spot friends.
Don't become a political forecaster, maybe.
I never am. I always, people ask me for forecasts. I say, I'm not a prophet. I'm a philosopher. But my ability to spot intellectual trends was not great. Look, the reason why I thought and still think it was a silly reproach is that the very idea of Eurocentrism was invented by the Enlightenment. It was the Enlightenment already in the 18th and late 17th century, which said to Europeans, you need to learn from other countries. You need to learn from other geographical perspectives. There's a lot wrong with Europe. And if we looked at the Persians, said Montesquieu, the Chinese, said Christian Wolff, the Tahitians or the Native Americans, said many people, we could learn a lot from those cultures. So the whole idea of Eurocentrism comes from the Enlightenment. And moreover, unlike academics who are, on enduring shitstorms on Twitter at most, these are people who risked their lives in order to say these things. There's one story about somebody who's not read anymore, but he was the major influence on the young Immanuel Kant, Christian Wolff. Christian Wolff learned Chinese, studied some Chinese philosophy, and made a public statement that the Chinese had morality, even though they didn't have, even though they weren't Christians. For this, he was given 48 hours to leave his job, his country, which was Prussia, or be executed. These people took real risks to argue for universalism, to argue that Europeans were by no means superior to other cultures, but had a lot to learn from them. Moreover, they absolutely criticized colonialism. Kant called it an evil and the source of all evils that can affect humankind. Diderot has passages in which he says, he's obviously not speaking to native South Africans, but if he could, he would say, let fly your poison arrows at the Dutch invaders. Don't believe a word they say. Leave not one of them alive to tell the tale. This is as strong anti-colonial rhetoric as you could give.
So, but isn't this just a simple confusion again between identity and ideas, that it does not necessarily follow that the identity of a white heteronormative man like Kant has to dictate how he thinks, because he is capable of creative thought. But this is fundamentally the thing that seems to be lost at the moment in academic circles and has caused perhaps, maybe this is just my view of it, having only recently been in university, I saw the genesis of these ideas coming through a fear, a deep fear, and probably a rightful one in many cases, that you were not supposed to speak about things of which you didn't understand. And that's, I suppose, where we're at now, the crossroads, is do we allow people to talk about ideas beyond themselves, or do we trap them in their identity? And this is, I suppose, where the big question is, which is how do we escape? Of course, the question at the end of your book, when you close the final page, is, okay, so how do we get out of this then? If left is not woke, how do we expel wokeness from the left? Well, that's my question, I suppose, is where do we go from here if we've got too much intermixing between ideas and identity? And, how do we separate this? It's quagmire. It's quagmire territory.
I do end the book with the example of Nazi Germany and the fact that different people who understood themselves to belong to the left couldn't get their act together. And the only reason why fascism triumphed in Germany was because of, you know, the infighting among people who had similar concerns on the left, but used up their energy in fighting, literally in street fighting in some ways. So I end the book with a warning. Look, I think the answer to how we do this is just do it. And I really like the way you put your question, because maybe you've given me a definition of woke. It's confusing identity with ideas. And it's not just that. I didn't just want to go after the identitarian issue. I wanted also to talk about power and justice and progress. But you're right that that's absolutely fundamental to the woke, and fundamental to the idea, fundamental to the objections that I and people whom I care about and respect and are my friends are appalled by. Look, culture is appropriation, as a friend of mine has put it.
So there can be no culture without cultural appropriation.
No, absolutely not. And you see that in Anthony Appiah's excellent book, The Lies That Bind. You know, capitalism is the wrong model for culture. Why do you have ideas, or do you make culture, if you don't want it to spread? You know, if you don't want it to influence other people. And, you know, the only way, it seems to me, to overcome racism and tribalism is to appreciate a culture that isn't your own. And you will never be able to work your way into all of them. But if everybody picked two cultures, preferably with different languages, were different from their own, and worked their way into reading the literature, listening to the music, looking at the art, you get several benefits by doing this. First of all, you get a better understanding of your own culture, because you realize what you're taking for granted and assuming that another set of people don't. And that's extremely important. Secondly, you learn thereby about the difference between you and members of another culture. But you also learn about what you have in common. And it's the only way to overcome the tribal differences that bring us down. And of course, I will never understand a culture that I didn't grow up in the way that I understand the one I grew up in. Of course not. But, you know, work and sensitivity is the only way to go. And by the way, the idea that woke is a war between younger and older people is actually not what I experience. I experience an awful lot of people who are still, I mean, the guardians of cultural institutions are still in their 50s and 60s, okay? And I experience both in Berlin, but also in the States, and also actually I have to say when I was in Britain last spring, I experience a lot of 60-year-olds. You mentioned guilt as a factor. A lot of 60-year-olds rushing to keep up with the woke and not partly out of fear of, and I'm not really sure of what, but people who are afraid to say things out loud that they will say after a while when they feel they can trust you.
I suppose my final question here then is, how urgent is the issue of factionalism within the left? How much is this going to come up against the unity, like it or lump it, the right does have a certain degree of unity that the left is currently missing. They seem to be able to keep a broad church and welcome people in with open arms to their movement, kind of whoever they are, whereas the left seems to be much more choosy about who they have on their side. How urgent is this fight then to end factionalism on the left?
It's extremely urgent. And it's also, as you probably know, has been a historical problem, for centuries on the left. I mean, if you want to take the historical left as starting with the French Revolution, you could say it was the thing that doomed the French Revolution, okay? So, but it's extremely urgent now. People talk about the rise of authoritarianism. I'm concerned about the threat of fascism, and people are scared to say it. But there are people in the current Israeli government who call themselves fascists, ministers. There are many people in the current Indian government who embrace fascist principles. And there are plenty of people in the United States who I think the word populist is fairly empty. I think that Donald Trump and his followers and people who are now incredibly powerful in Congress are failed fascists. They're failed so far. We have absolutely no guarantee that they won't win the next time around. So there are two things that the left needs to do, and I hope that my little book can contribute to it. Unite around certain principles, even if we have differences of language and emphasis, and that's fine, you know. You know, that's what freedom of speech is about, that's what reflection and interesting thinking is about. But those of us who are anti-fascists need to unite around certain principles, because if we don't, you know, first of all, there won't be enough of us to win elections that desperately need to be won, or even, I fear, you know, put off putches that may be down the road. I don't think anybody who has watched the last 5 years of international political movements seriously thinks this is an exaggeration. But the other thing, and I have to say it, is that a lot of woke excess is really pushing people towards the right in ways that, you know, is very dangerous. We're losing people. We're losing people.
I mean, if you're seeking unity in a place to call home politically, you're probably off better on the right, if that's just what you're looking for, than on the left as it stands.
Well, it depends. I mean, I just had a very disturbing encounter with somebody I've known most of my life, who I would have always, someone who's weird politically, but who was, I thought these were just people I read about, but I just spent time with a relative who I was shocked to see is, although she's been really, you know, comes from a left-wing family and, you know, been politically active all her life, is so put off by woke excess that she's supporting people I would like to call libertarians, but when I read more about them, it's quite far right. And that is happening. One hears about it happening. I just happen to have experienced it yesterday.
So here we're not talking about people turning to apathy. They're actually turning to activism on the other side. It's doing more than just pushing them, disenfranchising. It's pushing them all the way over.
Correct. It's doing both. I mean, it's pushing people towards saying, political activism, there's no, nothing I can really sign on to. I'm just gonna, you know, pull back, self-care, healthy eating, go back to the land.
Retreat.
There's exactly, let's just retreat from politics. There's no good and decent road to go right now. And that's a real danger.
You say optimism is about kind of coping with what we've got and making the best of it. Why should we be hopeful for something different?
Well, no, optimism is something slightly different. Optimism is making a prediction about the future, that things are getting better. I can't make that prediction because I see two huge dangers. And one is the threat of fascism, and the other is the threat of climate catastrophe. hope is not about the way the world is and is necessarily going to be. It's about changing the world. It's not about facts. It's about changing facts. It's about the idea that facts can be changed. But the only way they can possibly be changed is if we have some hope that we can change them. And otherwise, it's absolutely certain that we will go down the tubes. Now, this is an argument that originally comes from Immanuel Kant, but which I told Noam Chomsky, because Chomsky makes exactly the same argument. He says the world will come to an end if we retreat into cynicism and despair. And I said, Kant said that too. Chomsky says it a little more pithily, but both of them are right. It's a very simple choice. If we despair, we lose. If we're cynical, we lose. If we hope that we can stop these looming catastrophes, we have a chance. It's just a chance. That's why I'm not an optimist, but we do have a chance.
I think that's quite an apt note to finish on. Susan Nyman, thank you so much for your time.
This has been a pleasure to talk.
That was Susan Nyman, the moral philosopher and author of the new book, Left is Not Woke, which comes out soon. Her argument there was quite a straightforward one. If the left is going to have any chance of beating fascism and the far right, then it's going to have to find some new unity. How they're going to do that, I suppose, is another question. Thanks to her for coming on, to you for watching. This was Unheard.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.